Hello and welcome to another episode in MSU's Oral History of African Studies series. I'm Peter Lim, the African Studies bibliographer at MSU Libraries, and I'm joined today as co-interviewer by my colleague, Dr. Joe Lauer, African Studies librarian. Our very special guest today is Professor Emeritus John Statz of the Department of Agricultural, Food and Resource Economics, who has focused his career since 1975 on issues of agricultural development in Africa, particularly West Africa. He's co-editor of the most widely used textbook on agricultural development and numerous other books and articles, including one published by MSU Press in 2000 on democracy and development in Mali. He served between 1985 and 2008 as co-director of MSU's Food Security Group. His research and graduate teaching focused on improving food systems in West Africa, agricultural marketing and international trade, and improving performance of farmer cooperatives, among many other things. For over 28 years, he helped lead MSU's work on agricultural development in Mali. He mentored scores of young African professionals and played a key role in building MSU's partnerships in Africa. A departmental website lists as many as 54 grad students he mentored. In 2003, he was awarded MSU's Ralph Smuckler Award for Advancing International Studies and Programs. In 2009, the AFRE Excellence in Teaching Award, and in 2010 became a Distinguished Fellow of the African Association of Agricultural Economists. In 2013, Mali's president bestowed on Dr. Statz the title of Officier de l'Ordre National du Mali for his long-standing contribution to food policy analysis and capacity building in Mali. He retired in 2011, but continues working on West Africa, and I saw an article just recently that you co-authored. So welcome, Professor Statz.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you've had a long career in Africa. How did it get started, or how did you first get interested?
My family was a family of medical doctors, and they were very much involved in sort of giving back. My grandmother, for example, was a physician back starting in the 19-teens, and when she retired, she went to India to help train doctors. So that interest was there, and Albert Schweitzer was kind of my hero. So I went to college figuring I was going to be a medical doctor and follow in those footsteps. Two things happened. One, the courses that I took as a pre-med were so highly competitive that if you were sick a day, you couldn't borrow notes from anybody else because they were afraid you'd bust the curve and then you'd get into medical school, and they wouldn't. So I started thinking about whether I wanted to spend my life with people like that. And the second was I learned more about nutrition and malnutrition and started thinking, what's the point of treating people medically if you've got a food problem? So I was a biology major, I focused on nutrition, and I took a course, I was at Stanford, that was co-taught by a nutritionist and an ag economist on world food problems. Mm-hmm. And I went for the nutritionist and I got hooked by the ag economist. And at that time, Stanford had a center called the Food Research Institute, mm-hmm. which was an mm-hmm. excellent applied agricultural economics group. And so I started taking courses there. I got a job with a Ghanaian professor there, Tete Kofi, and spent time getting data from him on the world cocoa market. He had a theory that the cocoa market was being manipulated by the big London brokers. So that led to one thing after another. I then applied to grad school at Cornell for a PhD in ag econ. I did a master's there. I was to go to the Philippines, actually, to do my research. Mm-hmm. And I was going to sort of focus on Asia. And a week before I left, Marcos declared martial law. So that put an end to that. So I did a thesis on secondary data. And the other part of it was, as is often the case, there's a woman involved. So, and she was doing graduate work at University of Michigan, and we were meeting on weekends in the middle of Ontario. And after 2 years, that got old. So I started looking for a job in Ann Arbor as I approached the end of my master's degree. And I ended up getting a job at CRED, the Center for Research on Economic Development, which was a center that focused particularly on Francophone Africa. And so I moved to Ann Arbor. We got married, still are. And got hired by CRED. This was soon after the Great Sahelian Drought. Yep. And USAID was putting a lot of money into the Sahel, looking for a center that had French-speaking economists, and found CRED was one of the few places that did. So they got contracts. Their problem was they had no expertise in agricultural economics. Mm. So their solution was to hire a bunch of sort of junior ag economists and teach them French. And I was one of those. Okay. Chris Delgado, who's now at the World Bank, was at IFPRI for a long time, was another. There were four of us. So that got me going. My first job at CRED was helping African grad students who were coming to U of M to get settled, and most of those were Francophones. So I did that for a while, and then CRED got a large contract to look at the organization of the livestock production and marketing systems in West Africa. And that sent me to Cote d'Ivoire for about a year and a half, looking at livestock marketing, and it sort of went on from there.
Yeah, okay.
So that's sort of how I got hooked.
At some point in life, you got sucked into the graduate program, mm-hmm, at MSU.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, that kind of fits in with the history of MSU.
Sure.
MSU's work at ACT. I mean, obviously, it's Elliot, mm-hmm, Berg that,
right,
right, he's got you started in Africa down there, but okay.
Yeah, actually, when I was considering grad school, the two places that were actively recruiting me were MSU and Cornell.
Okay.
I'd heard really good things about Cornell, and so I decided to go there, being headstrong, knowing I didn't need to be that close to my girlfriend at that time. That got corrected later on. So she was doing a PhD in clinical psychology at U of M, so we essentially put each other through grad school. When she came close to finishing, then I wanted to do a PhD, and I've been in touch with Carl and others at MSU, yeah, so I came here for that.
Okay, okay. You started graduate school here what year?
I started in 79, and then I was still working for CRED, so then I dropped out for a semester because I had to finish work with CRED, and then I came back in 80.
Okay, okay.
And you had the early work in Cote d'Ivoire, but somehow you landed in Mali.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Well, when we were in Cote d'Ivoire, we took a vacation. It was this combination vacation and work for me up in Mali, because I was looking at the livestock trade between the Sahel and the coast.
Yeah, it was the Entente region?
The Entente region, right.
Various Francophone
and
countries.
I'd been working with actually a Dutch researcher on weight loss of animals as they were walked down to the coast. So he was weighing them up in Mali, and I was weighing them once they got down to Cote d'Ivoire. We tagged them. So I wanted to go see him, and we'd also wanted to see some of Mali. So we went up there, and Mali's a place that once you're there, you kind of fall in love with it. And just the hospitality of all the people. And we had been, for example, used to being stopped at roadblocks in Cote d'Ivoire, you know, to check papers and being shaken down for bribes and so on. And we'd go up to Mali and there'd be a roadblock. And once they found out we weren't French, the cops would invite us to have tea with them and talk rather than ask for a bribe. So that was a nice experience.
Okay. And then you got hired. You finished your PhD here and got hired by the department here.
Yes.
Okay, so maybe say a word or two about where there's a long history of work in Africa in that department. I don't know if you want to say a word about that or not.
Yeah, what's now AFRI, what was Ag Econ, really was involved in Africa since 1960 with Nsukka and so on. So there was a long history of that. When I got there, there was the Sahel Masters training program there, so there were a lot of French-speaking ag economists from the Sahel, so I felt at home in that way. I made some links there. And at that time, early mid-80s, there was a transition in the funding. Carl Eicher had a large grant from USAID, and it went into a new phase, which became called the Food Security in Africa Cooperative Agreement. And one of the key themes of that was the impact of changing regulations like market liberalization, technology, and institutions on food security, where at that time, people in the World Bank and so on simply had kind of simplistic views that, you know, just get the state out of the market somehow and everything would be great. And then you had the pure Aggies who said it's just a technological question, and then the institutionalists who said, you know, change the institutions. And our view was that with some combination of that, you had to sort out. So that was a major theme. And at that time, 84, 85, Mali had just entered a big reform in its market, and particularly the agricultural market. They were moving from a system of fixed prices and the government setting production quotas to a more market-oriented system. And so AID was interested in that theme. Mali was interested in that theme. And so we were invited to go to Mali to explore whether there was a research opportunity there. Okay. And the third component is we had a dynamite Africa, a Malian grad student that was looking for a dissertation topic. That was Josue Dione. Josue is now the senior advisor to the African Union on Agricultural Development. So
Coming back to your work on the ground, I mean, you're flying in, you're flying out in Mali. What was it like over these decades? I mean, what sort of work did you do? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you were mentoring, and you there were African students coming back here, and you were going there to give your experience. But could you just paint a little bit of a picture for the listeners about the sorts of things you did? And obviously, it changed. You mentioned some of the how different institutions conceived these bottlenecks, but. But I expect that although food security has been perhaps one of the continuities in your work, there were other things that came to the fore.
Surely. And food security is a huge umbrella. You can stick lots of things in it. So that actually facilitated the arrangements. But when we first started, there was an absolute lack of information about who was doing what in the economy. The Malian government, under some donor pressures, was going to allow, quote, the market to set prices. But there was very little information about who could respond to that, which farmers were actually producing a surplus for a market, which ones were net buyers of food, where the food flows were, would traders really respond, did they have the capacity to respond, who did, and so on. So our first step was to try to gather information on that. We put together a team. Josue was there, but then I got a call from Ann Arbor, from my former colleague, saying, we got a really good Malian master's student who wants to do some research for his thesis. Could you help him? And so I said, sure. He came up. This is Nango Dembele, who's now the minister of livestock and fisheries. And Nango wanted to do some econometrics on Malian data. I said, well, you can do that, but the data's so bad, I wouldn't believe anything you got. But if we can talk to the people at CRED, if you want to come work for us for a year, you can gather your own data on how traders are responding and so on, and then use that for your thesis. Well, he thought that was a great idea. And that gave us a team of two really sharp Malians. We put together an office, and we started doing surveys, first at the farm level, on who's producing what, you know, which farmers had a surplus, and so on. And we tried to structure that in a way where you had different parts of the country that had different agroecological potential and different institutional rules. For example, a cotton zone where there was a lot of good extension and so on versus an area around Bamako where there was much less. So Josue took the chunk on the farmer level, and then Nango was doing surveys amongst traders on their trading practices and so on. And as he described it initially, under the old regime where private trade was illegal, it was organized like the drug trade. You had to only trade with a few people, small quantities, you know, only trade people you knew well.
Black market to get the price,
You wanted. And that was all in a process of change. So he put together a really interesting set of histories of about 90 traders with all their investments over time as they adjusted and so on. And that ended up being his doctoral dissertation.
Okay.
So that was the first step, was getting the information and then feeding that into the policy debate.
Yeah.
Which made a big difference because people were talking in terms of ideology, both the donors and the Malians from different ideologies, and we'd bring data which was sort of in between and get the discussion going. And that fed into, there was a technical office in the Ministry of Agriculture that was supporting this reform process.
Okay.
So that was the first set of activities. The second one was it became clear that as you got a more open market or a liberalized market, information was really important. And so then the question was, how would farmers or traders get information? Mm-hmm. And we were asked by AID to help what was then the Malian Grain Board, which previously had the official monopoly on grain trade, organize a market information system. Mm-hmm. Go out, and because we had been collecting prices under our previous research, which was one of the few sources of market information, because they said, can you institutionalize that and put it together with work that others are doing on that? So this is an area that Nango took the lead on, and we brought in some other staff, ended up getting scholarships for several Malians to come here and do master's degrees and other technical training who ended up being the staff of the market information system.
Okay.
And that, I think, has been quite a success. It served as a model for other countries. They ended up developing a network that now covers, I think, 10 of the 15 ECOWAS countries of market information systems that are modeled on that. So you can, it's like the farm news here. You can hear it on the radio in the morning, what the prices are.
How did they disseminate the news? A radio or?
It's radio in local languages.
Okay.
There's also bulletins that are sent out electronically to organizations like banks who want to make loans to traders and need to value the inventory. Paper. And it's on the TV as well. But radio's really the most important.
Especially at the early stages.
I don't know how much TV was early.
I mean, this whole question of data is a very interesting one, because just this morning we had a meeting of the new African Alliance Partnership, and your colleague Tom Jane is co-directing that. And one of the issues I raised from the library was the issue of data sets and institutional repositories. And, of course, Mali's has its own particular case, limitations and opportunities, but certainly in some African countries there's now a prospect of developing digital data sets. And that might be something further down the track. But I looking at your list of projects or a list of your major projects, I noticed that you came back to something you mentioned very early on in your career, which was an interest in nutrition. There was a Mali Agricultural Growth / Nutrition Linkages project from 1998 to 2002. And then these different projects, the Mali Marketing Information Project, 1998 to 2003, the Mali Food Security Initiatives in different phases over many years. And then later on, you moved into a little bit more broadly. You looked at the regional situation, the West Africa market information projects, again coming back to data. And then there was another one on strengthening regional agricultural integration, and more recently aspects of guiding investments in sustainable agricultural markets. So obviously these are all connected to, you know, agricultural economics. But what about this broader picture then of West Africa? How did you fit into that?
Well, it became pretty clear starting in the 90s that you couldn't talk about Mali's agricultural development without looking at what's going on regionally. Those markets, the borders are very porous. And so you're operating in a regional economy. And that got us very interested in export trade and so on. At the same time, as we did the work in Mali, we got approached by USAID's Sahel West Africa office and said, could you replicate this regionally, starting with work with the Institut du Sahel, INSA, which is based in Bamako, which is the one of the research arms of SILS. And so we began in, I believe it was 89, a program that Josue Dione led after he finished his PhD here, that developed a network of researchers across the Sahel, across the Francophone countries, that were dealing with similar problems. They were all going through this market reform process. They were all trying to deal with a lot of the same questions. So we ran workshops where people would bring their research on the similar theme. We'd give small grants, and they'd compare results on things like impact of market liberalization on who is responding. Or later on, there was a big effort when the CFA franc was devalued in 1994. There was a big question about what was going to be the impact of that. So we ran a whole series of research. And that was useful not only for the comparative research, but I think it built a lot of networks across countries amongst researchers that have continued. So these people got to know each other. They were comparing things. There was a lot of cross-learning going on. That was very helpful. Then much later, you mentioned the Strengthening Agricultural Integration Program, which grew out of the world food crisis in 2008. That was a bit of serendipity also. One of the organizations that funds a lot of work in this part of the world on agriculture is the Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, which is sort of the charitable arm of the Syngenta Corporation. And that's a Swiss-based organization, and it had focused very much on technology development. And right before 2008, they had a shift in leadership, and their new president of the organization was a Swiss fellow whom I happened to go to grad school with at Cornell. And he was very much interested in policy. So one day I was in Bamako, and I got a call from him and said, look, we've been funding technology work across the Sahel for 20 years. Now we have this price spike, and all the countries are putting in trade bans. You can't export your food. We need it at home. He says, it seems to me that this sends a message to farmers that you're free to sell as long as prices are low. And that really doesn't help on technology adoption. So could you guys consider any research on what are some alternative to trade bans? How can you deal with food security issues while allowing there to be greater integration across these economies? And so we undertook a number of pieces, again, regional work across countries looking at issues.
What kind of solutions did you come up with to solve the problem of people, the poor people being priced out of?
One of the things we said is that you can't look at these things separately, which people had done. They'd looked at safety net questions separately from market reform. Said, if you're going to do market reform, the only way you can do it politically is to develop more secure safety nets. So we've begun to look at things like monetary transfers, other ways of targeting food aid. It's tough when everybody's poor, how you target these things. One of the things that Nango Dembélé was thinking about prior to his current position as minister in charge of livestock, he was minister in charge of food security. And he was beginning to explore the possibility of using cell phones for monetary transfers as an alternative to shipping food to people. So those are the kinds of things. But
they have implemented monetary transfers fairly widespread, or just
still
talking stage.
You're still talking a little trials, but
that's certainly prominent in East Africa.
It's prominent in Latin America. You know, Mexico, Brazil.
I don't know about the monetary transfer, but government transfers.
They do have the cell phone transfers for monetary. They have the infrastructure now.
The infrastructure is now.
But
there.
The question is, can you use it as a social safety net? You know, are the really poor the ones who have access to the cell phones?
It's sort of a broader question. What's changed in Africa since you've been involved?
Lots have changed. One of the things that really struck me when I started in Mali with MSU in 85, I'd sort of been away from that part of the world since the late 70s when I was working with CRED. And when I went into with CRED and I would be talking to development experts, quote, local officials about major constraints, you know, what's stopping production here or marketing. The answer, at least in Côte d'Ivoire, I always got was, il faut changer la mentalité paysan. You got to change peasant mentality. And one of my first visits to Mali, I went out to a station that was doing research around Bamako, and there was a young guy who had just come back from Texas Tech with a master's degree, and he was showing me some stuff on crop yields and productivity. It didn't seem to go anywhere, and I said, what do you think's the problem? And he says, that's a good question. I think it's aluminum toxicity, but I got the numbers. I'll run them, come back tomorrow, and we can talk. So, I mean, that was a huge change. It's kind of more empirical approach.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Was it aluminum toxicity?
It looked like it was aluminum toxicity from his data, you know, and you can address that through liming and other kinds of things. But, I mean, just the notion that you had some data and you could actually look at it rather than assuming that all these farmers were just stupid.
And now today we've got these enormous problems of desertification and global warming hitting the Sahel.
Yeah.
So I guess in many ways things aren't getting any better.
Is that desertification? They were talking about that in the 70s, and of course, they, being a historian, I can tell you they talked about it in the 30s big time, too. Is it gotten worse?
My impression is what we see is more more volatility in weather, but not necessarily desertification. There are a lot of problems of floods, for example, and so on. You got more energy in the atmosphere, so a lot of odd things are happening. Partly, you know, desertification is people being up in areas where there's low productivity and they're cutting.
Rainfall is too low.
And they're cutting down things for firewood. And if you can raise productivity in the more productive zones, you keep people from moving up in those areas. In Niger, there's been some very promising work on reforestation and so on. It seems to have had some important impacts.
You mentioned the Sahel Institute, which is a particular interest of mine because I visited there in 1979. That has continued to be a prominent player, or where it did certain things anyway through the 90s, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's still there. It's had a bit of a rivalry with another organization in Dakar.
Which has
a broader mandate for agricultural research.
The name will come to me.
So there's been some discussion of who has the mandate, although in terms of substance, INSA has done some very interesting stuff. For example, we helped them develop an online database for pesticides that are approved for use in the Sahel. So there's and which are banned, and they have a regional system now for approval, so it's not country by country.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're interested in that, either as a pesticide dealer or anything else, you can go very quickly online and find this kind of stuff, which was information that wasn't easily available.
They were talking about creating networks back in 1979, and they said.
Yeah, now what they've lost a little bit. They had a very good demography center at INSA. That's really shrunk.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was that's somewhat of a, away from the technical aspects, but the other things. It's sort of a question of your own research agenda. Have you had a research agenda, or does it just follow with the money?
No. I mean, the central research agenda, I think, to me, is sort of an institutional one of, how do you structure markets in a way that allows broader participation of the population? What are the complementary kinds of investments you have to make so that it doesn't all end up in the hands of the very rich? And things like, what are the impacts of agricultural growth and market liberalization on things like nutrition, the work that we did earlier?
And your very early work, I think, was on cooperative farmers.
Yeah, that was actually my dissertation was on cooperatives in the U.S., but the issue of cooperation seemed to me to be the same.
Yes.
In the U.S., the issue was how do larger cooperatives structure themselves to serve a very diverse group of members who have really different interests, and there are a lot of cases where co-ops have blown up over that issue. Are you serving the large farmers, small farmers, different commodities? And it came down to trying to figure out solutions that were mutually beneficial. And I tried to do some modeling of that with game theory. But that same issue is a central issue in social organization, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, if we look at this country, obviously growth of agribusiness mm-hmm. is very significant and large farming enterprises. Mm-hmm. In Mali, what sort of changes have taken place in ownership of farms over the years? I mean, which direction is that sort of thing going? Because mm-hmm. clearly that would in some ways determine the maneuverability of the economy and how, you know, these different schemes could operate.
Right.
I mean, we hear a lot about land grabs in Ethiopia, Mozambique.
Kenya.
You know, big players mm-hmm. from the Gulf will come in and buy up a lot of farms, and the small farmers will just be discarded by the side of the road. What about Mali here?
In Mali, as in a lot of these countries, the land tenure issue is a real time bomb. It's a huge time bomb. And there's been some so-called land grabs, but they haven't been so much by outsiders as they are by well-moneyed Malians.
Right, right.
Who've been able to get access to land, and then under a system in which tenure arrangements are pretty tenuous, exclude others. This has been true both on farming and also in urban areas. Particularly as urban areas expand, you have a process of turning rural land into urban lots, and who controls that? It's been controlled by the mayors. There have been, in recent years, in the last couple of years in Mali, big disputes where mayors have been thrown in jail and so on over this process. So that continues to be a big issue. Agriculture in Mali continues to be dominated by small farms. There's some question about whether for growing things like millet and sorghum, you can really get a decent living out of 2 or 3 hectares of that. You may need larger scale for that kind of thing. But with higher value products, you need less. So we've done some work in looking at returns to different kinds of products and what that implies for a scale of agriculture, and then how do you link that with agri-processing. One of the big issues of agri-processing is getting quality of products. We interviewed at one point the local manufacturer of Maggi cubes, which are a bouillon that people use for their soups and so on. And one of the key ingredients of that is dried onions. Well, Mali produces a ton of onions, and they're importing dried onions from Germany, you know. And they say,
globalization.
You know, well, yeah, it's globalization, but they say it's a question of getting the quality when we need it. And so how do you organize that?
What about this age-old question also with food security, of the balance between food crops and cash crops, like cotton and that? I mean, how is that playing out these days in Mali?
I think most people in Mali don't see there a potential conflict in that. Some of the early work we did in the cotton zone showed that the farmers who were producing the largest surplus of grain were those who were involved in cotton. Because cotton provided the capital to get equipment, it provided access to fertilizer and so on. More recently, we're just finishing some work on mango exports and linking small farmers to the mango export market. There's a firm there that is working with about 700 small mango farmers who are getting their mangoes right into supermarkets in Europe. So, well, with 2 hectares or 1 hectare of mangoes, you can make a whole lot of money. But what they're interested in is, if they can get the next step, is moving from sort of the traditional management that gives about 2 tons per hectare to technologies that are used in Latin America that can get 30 tons per hectare. Mm-hmm. Well, if they could do that, it involves drip irrigation and a number of other things, the potential for smaller farmers to get higher incomes is quite a bit.
So over the years, development in Africa as a whole has been flat from 1970 to 2000. It's been creeping up since. Does Mali sort of follow that plan?
Yeah. Mali production and production per head has gone up quite substantially
since
really since the early 90s.
Oh, okay.
When they began.
actually did
the reforms.
Started the reforms and the liberalization of politics, or the
I think that helped quite a bit actually, because it facilitated a lot of adoption of technologies, some of which were on the shelf, but nobody had any incentive to adopt them at the time. For example, improved quality post-harvest processing of rice. They used to thresh rice by driving a truck over it, and that leaves a lot of stones and broken things and so on. And we talked with some colleagues who in the Malian Research Service who were just beating their heads against the wall. They said, we have all these techniques, no one will adopt them. Mm. Well, as soon as you let markets start paying a premium for quality, the farmers started coming to the extension people rather than vice versa to get the technology. Because they saw an incentive to do that. So that's helped. If you believe the UN FAO statistics, food balance sheets, calories per capita in Mali from the 60s to 2009, or from the 80s, early 80s, which was a drought period, to 2009, went up nearly 50%. Nutrition's improved. Poverty levels, as measured by the National Poverty Scale, has dropped about 50%. It's still high.
Yeah. Okay.
But things have improved.
And you haven't had whatever inequality you got. There's always some, but it hasn't gotten worse, or has it?
I think it's gotten a little worse, but I think that's been more the urban classes. There's been some. People have really captured a lot of.
Okay, and that's been playing into the crisis in Mali in some ways. And Tom Jane this morning was saying that Africa now has roughly 50% urbanization rate. So obviously the whole urban thing, and even urban agriculture, gardening, and that could be important. Mm-hmm. But, there's a lot of food for thought, if I can use that metaphor. So thanks so much, Professor Statz, for speaking to MSU Library Series on African Studies at MSU.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.